Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck. I'm Fred Mogul, sitting in for the vacationing John Schaefer. Consider the 20th century's great conductors, and you might think of silver-haired tyrants who inspired fear among musicians and cult-like devotion from fans. Lately, a different breed of maestro is emerging. The New York Philharmonic's next music director, Alan Gilbert, is known to be a friend of many of that orchestra's musicians and is just 40 years old. The Los Angeles Philharmonic recently appointed Gustavo Dudamel, a 26-year-old Venezuelan with rock star hair, as its next music director. By choosing the young and sometimes unknown, what do orchestras stand to gain or to lose? In a moment, we'll talk to a musician who played under some of the great dictator conductors of the past, but first we're joined in the studio by Oliver Condy, editor of BBC Music Magazine. Oliver, welcome.
Welcome, thank you.
And on the phone right now is James Conlon. He's the music director of the Los Angeles Opera and the Ravinia Festival, and it's his recording of Stravinsky's Symphony in Three Movements that we're listening to here in the background. Welcome, Mr. Conlon.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
So, Oliver, now along with New York and L.A., there's lots of these new young faces emerging. Pittsburgh has hired Manfred Honeck. Dallas has hired Jaap van Zweden. Similar examples in Europe. Why are these up-and-comers up-and-coming now?
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that to be a conductor several decades ago, you had to go through much more of a sort of lengthy training process. They expected conductors to be composers. They expected conductors to be versed in being a repetiteur. And now conductors seem to sort of come straight from music college and get thrust into the limelight, really. Orchestras want a bit more spontaneity, I suppose. They want people to be they want to give the young a bit more of an opportunity. It gives the orchestras a bit more freshness.
They don't have to pay their dues as much. I mean, I imagine in the past, probably they would have liked to have gotten a podium if they could have. And in fact, many of them did get some exposure at fairly young ages to symphonies, but they didn't necessarily own them as music directors full time. You know, installed full time at the podium like this latest group we're talking about.
Well, I think an awful lot more conductors are, because they're traveling around a lot more, taking on very much more orchestras. The LSO, for example, has a huge roster of conductors, ranging from
the London Symphony Orchestra,
which has from the very top Sir Colin Davis, who's just turned 80, down to Daniel Harding, who's their principal guest conductor. In fact, he's under 30, so they're giving the whole roster of conductors an opportunity, and I'm not quite sure the orchestra's had this huge list. I think the London Symphony Orchestra has something like 8 conductors assigned to it, which perform at various times during the year.
That's quite a, if nothing else, a great number of different people to be working with an orchestra. And as we're saying, a lot of them are much younger than they would be in the past. Is this good for institutions like that, both in the quantity and the quality and the age of these conductors?
I think it'd be good and bad, can't it, really? A conductor needs, I think, to form a relationship with an orchestra. And when we talked to the 4 conductors for our feature in the magazine, we talked to Ricardo Muti, Marin Alsop, Tugan Sokiev and Sir Colin Davis, and I think all of them said that the problem is that conductors don't have this chance to really bond with their orchestras. They're flying around so much. They have to study their scores on the plane a lot of the time just to fit in some of the studying. And I think that's one of the reasons why conductors can't be as despotic and tyrannous as they could, because if you're a conductor that only conducts the London Philharmonic, say, 2 months of the year, you have to get to know them all the time. And how do you get to know someone? Well, you start off by being nice, I suppose.
Right. Well, like you say, it has its pros and its cons, and does force them to be more personable. And why are they traveling so much now? Is this the economics of orchestras today?
It's the economics of orchestras. It's also because they can. Conductors just want more experience. They want to do more. I mean, look at Valery Gergiev. I've never seen someone travel around quite so much. He needn't, I suppose, but he wants to.
He's in the St. Petersburg, one of the operatic or symphony symphony is there?
The Mariinsky.
He's the theatre.
Yeah, absolutely. The Mariinsky in St. Petersburg. He's also now the principal conductor of the London Symphony Orchestra. I think he's still at Rotterdam, unless he's just given that up. He was at Gothenburg. I think that's been taken over by Vladimir Jurovsky. So I think conductors just can travel, and they do.
Now, James Conlin, you're in your 50s, not to out your age here, but you've been on the scene for a while, a lot longer. You're less than some and longer than some of the others we're talking about. You know, where do you feel you fit in generationally and musically with this other group we're seeing coming up?
Well, to start out with, I see nothing wrong with outing my age because I'm proud of it, and I have, you know, more than 30 years of experience behind me, and you see tendencies and you see things come into fashion. First of all, I was young myself, and I started young, and I gained a lot of experience. On the other hand, I do not fly around like a maniac. I have a history of long, deep relationships as a music director. Pretty long in many cases. My first was Rotterdam Philharmonic, which you just mentioned, which was 8 years. I was 13 years as general music director of the city of Cologne. That was both the symphony and the opera. I was 9 years as principal conductor of the Paris Opera, which is the longest 10 years since 1939. And I have been with the Cincinnati May Festival, which is America's oldest choral festival, for 29 years. I've started in Ravinia. I've just finished my third season. That's a festival where I have an association as a guest since 30 years. I had almost 30 years as a guest at the Metropolitan Opera. I'm starting a new relationship in Los Angeles.
Well, let's talk a little.
That everybody is flying around in airplanes, not being serious. I'm extremely serious.
No, and I don't think anyone meant to cast any aspersions that way about you, or even about the more peripatetic conductors. But let's talk a little bit about stylistically where you might fit in. Given your experience level, what you've learned, and what you think you might be able to get out of musicians today after holding all these posts and working with different lengths of time with different orchestras, what has that brought out in you as a musician in working with a whole crew of musicians?
Well, first of all, I don't think that any artists necessarily fit in or don't fit. And I have always walked to the beat of my own drum, and I think every artist ultimately must do that. In other words, you have to respond to what is your artistic, what demands of you artistic. I've split my time equally between symphonic conducting and opera all my life because both are necessary. And parenthetically, I would also say that was so much the case for the first half of the 20th century. That's broken down a little bit now. What's broken down also is the question of age. In essence, there's no age in art, and I have tremendous sympathy for all of the young conductors today, even though they're another generation from me, that are emerging, because I emerged and I had to deal with all of the difficulties of being younger than most of the orchestras that I was conducting, and I understand exactly what that means. There's a lot of greatly gifted young people. There are a lot of greatly gifted middle-aged people, and I don't know what an old conductor is, because theoretically we're supposed to be able to go on to 90.
Right, but are there things, I mean, surely you've learned some lessons over the years. There's some things you probably have learned about communicating with musicians, say, that you would do differently today than you would have done 20 years ago.
Well, I mean, I hope I've continued to mature and evolve. I mean, that's a judgment for other people to make or not. When the subject comes up of why are conductors different today, why are they not like the tyrannical of generation before, frankly, the whole world has changed. Well, I should say the whole Western world has changed. We don't know dictatorship any longer. There are no more monarchs. Every democracy elects its leaders, and they are answerable ultimately to the people they govern. And I don't think that's any different now in the orchestra world. It's not that you don't have a clear and imposing vision of what you want to do musically, and you have to, I mean, you don't vote on the tempo, for you don't vote in that respect. But the fact is that you must lead by inspiration, by collaboration, by one amongst equals today, for the reason that that's what society is today. Society expects that. They expect their leaders to be answerable too. In good cases, they're willing to give them a chance and they're willing to cooperate, and if they see results, they will continue to operate. But I think the conductor must attain this by inspiration and competence and not any longer by dictatorship, first of all, because it's not possible. Just as you say, people travel today because they can. You can't do it by dictatorship because you can't.
Right. We're on Soundcheck. I'm Fred Mogul sitting in for John Schaefer. We're talking by phone with James Conlon, the music director of the Los Angeles Opera and the Ravinia Festival, and in the studio with Oliver Condy, the editor of the BBC Music magazine. Let's get a bit of compare and contrast here and kind of a stump the guest and for that matter, the host here. We're going to listen to two recordings of Bartók's Concerto for Orchestra, one by a distinguished older conductor and one by a younger new breed. We won't tell you the order or who they are. And it's a little bit of an exercise. We're going to see what we hear in them and what we might discern. And coming up now, here's the second version of the same piece of music. Okay, two versions of Bartók's Concerto for Orchestra. By the way, listeners, we'd like you to weigh in on this, not debate, this discussion, both about these two pieces of music and their interpretation, and about the broader subject of what you like to see when you go to the symphony and what these different generations might mean, if anything. Well, one of the reasons we wanted to do this sort of blind taste test is to put out the idea that what really matters, of course, is the music, and if we close our eyes, it shouldn't really matter whether our conductor is wearing a black T-shirt or white tie and tails. I hope my guests, Oliver Condy and James Conlon, have been taking a few notes as those excerpts play. Oliver, tell me a little bit what you heard in those respective pieces, and then we'll go to the guests.
I felt the first one was very clean, very beautifully played. The brass was very smooth. Everything was ordered, and I thought the strings were nicely agitated. I thought that the playing was absolutely superb, and it built up this wonderful climax. I must say, I did prefer the second one, although, you know, it started much more stately, with the brass being slightly raw. I thought the whole thing had a much more tense atmosphere to it. I don't know if James agrees, but I would guess that the first one was a younger conductor, the second one was an older. But I'm, you know, this is just me speculating.
Right, this is me putting you on the spot. How about you, James? What do you think? I don't know if you were taking notes, but first versus second?
Well, I think I'm going to have to defer more to Oliver on this because, to be honest, the sound is so bad over this telephone. It was very hard for me to actually make out. There was a lot of reverberation, so it was very hard for me to make out anything, frankly, except for the tempo. I wouldn't want to make a judgment on the detail, the clarity, or the quality of sound, because I really couldn't tell.
That seems fair. Now, yes, Oliver does have an advantage. He's got headphones here in the studio, and I'll tell both of you that one of them is by George Zell, the legendary conductor of the Cleveland Philharmonic, and one is by the recently appointed Dudamel, excuse me, I'm blanking momentarily on the Gustavo. I apologize, Dudamel, recently appointed to Los Angeles. So, any thoughts now that you two know that?
I'd still go with Gustavo Dudamel on the first and George Zell on the second. I think. I mean, I would have thought.
Right. Well, and whew, You got that one right. Well, how about that? We didn't make you guess the conductor cold, but it's just a little way of sort of touching base with what we're really talking about.
But
here.
I think the record industry has you know does come to bear an awful lot on the whole question of how a conductor you know behaves. And I certainly know talking to while I'm here in New York, you know, I'm seeing quite a lot of record companies, and there's some stories coming out about the way that record labels treated conductors and the way they sent limos to their hotels and the way they were able to treat them almost like Hollywood superstars. And I think conductors these days, because the record industry is much more open and people use the record industry not so much for making the big bucks but for spreading their name, I think it's much more about sort of a good public image these days. And the record industry is not able to kowtow as much to the conductor. So I think, you know, there's much more of the conductor just has to get on with the orchestra to survive.
Right. Well, you set this up very nicely because that's what we're going to talk about now is a little bit taken together as an instrument. The conductor is ultimately trying to get the best sound he or she can out of the orchestra, and they do that together with lots of painstaking rehearsal, and they obviously do it together in performance. We're going to listen to a historic moment with Arturo Toscanini in rehearsal, and you know he's well. I won't characterize it. Let's listen to it. It's in 1950, and listen to it for yourself.
Corona, seconda volta. Andiamo, corso. Io non voglio accompagnare.
Sì, signore.
Sì, signore, un corno. Un corno, sì, signore. E no, signore.
Ciao, ripeti, maestro.
Ma come ripeti? Se sbagli, non parlare, per carità, non parlare. Non parlare, che se parlo io apro le...
So you don't need to understand Italian to understand a little bit about what's going on there. No passare, don't speak, he's telling his musician. Don't justify yourself to me. Now, Oliver, you know, in the old days, this is the kind of things, so legend would have us believe, that would happen all the time. Have you heard from musicians some of these stories?
Absolutely. I mean, it's funny. I heard from several people about the way that Bernstein used to conduct, and you hear so many sort of conflicting reports of how Bernstein apparently used to terrorize his orchestra. You know, people were actively scared of him. But then I hear stories. I was talking to Marion Alsop, and she said he was one of the most sort of considerate, generous conductors she ever knew. And you know, as soon as he walked through the door, you know, the orchestra would play 50% better, even without him raising the baton. So you can have it both ways, really. You can be quite strict with your orchestra. You can be quite dictatorial, and you can get results.
James, how about you? Have you behaved this way? Could you do it without repercussions?
Well, it depends also on the culture. I mean, I think we've come. Things have changed since, and I happen to know these Toscanini rehearsals, and I mean they're fascinating to listen to. And of course, I adore him. But that is another time. I do not think that you can do that without consequences in today's world. That doesn't mean there aren't moments of big tension between orchestras and conductors. And I think also has a lot to do with what makes an orchestra function. It's not necessary in America. I know it's not necessarily in Britain. Because there's a deep sense of discipline in those two cultures, playing on the team, that just there's a value to doing work well in and of itself. Now that is you can find that across Europe, but you'll find very different attitudes about what makes people predisposed to do that work. And sometimes in some contexts, people need the tension, people need the stress, need the pressure. I certainly know in my German years that it's quite a different atmosphere to get the results that you feel are necessary amongst the people who are themselves very, very, very serious. But they're a little bit more used to, historically, they're more used to if not an antagonistic approach, at least that the conductor is an authority, and if the conductor doesn't fully exercise that authority, they're not quite as willing to put everything into Latin countries. You have
well. Let's hold that thought for after the break, and we're going to come back and speak to a musician who played under some of these conductors of yore. We're going to hear, as we do go into that break, Alan Gilbert, the incoming 40-year-old music director of the New York Philharmonic. I'm Fred Mogul, and this is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm Fred Mogul, sitting in for John Schaefer. Today's maestros can't be the dictators of the past, or can they? To answer this question, we're joined here in the studio by Oliver Condy, editor of BBC Music Magazine, and on the phone is James Conlin, the music director of the Los Angeles Opera and the Ravinia Festival, whose conducting we're currently listening to, the Goldmark Violin Concerto. Also joining us now, by way of phone, is Samuel Mogged. He joined the first violin section of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra under the legendary and imposing music director Fritz Reiner in 1958. He later became the orchestra's concertmaster, a position he held until his retirement last year. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, Sam, Fritz Reiner, of all the legendary conductors, was admired but feared, or that's what we're told. But how much was how feared was he? I guess is one question. But also, you know, how much was this personality necessary to deliver those great performances?
Well, first, let me say to James Conlin, congratulations on a lovely Ravinia season this year, and nice to hear you again.
Thank you, Sam. We worked together many years, and I'm delighted to be on the same program with you.
I should say. Always a pleasure. Let me tell about Fritz Reiner. Well, of course, he was one of the last of the breed of dictatorial conductors in the same mode as Toscanini and, you know, George Sell and Fritz Reiner and this type. I think it existed mainly because there was no security for musicians, and conductors could do or say or fire you on the spot, which I did see happen.
Right. I mean, Reiner was known for that very thing, for firing people for making mistakes in concerts. What, can you recall any time that happened?
Well, yes. I remember a rehearsal even that we had an extra percussion player, and he didn't do exactly what Dr. Reiner wanted, and he just said, get out, you know. Well, it was kind of an embarrassing situation for everybody, the players and the person, of course. But those were the times, and that was the end of an era. And I think after that, it suddenly got better with contractual limitations and more respect given and better working conditions. And the whole thing evolved into something really very beautiful.
Right. There were union rules, tenure changes in what a conductor could and couldn't do. Now,
right.
You joined in 1958, as we said, under Fritz Reiner.
Fritz Reiner, yes.
Now, in subsequent conductors, how did that power shift change? We talked about it in the abstract. Tell us about it specifically, working with Maestro George Schulte.
Well, when George Schulte came in here, he was a gentleman, and he treated the musicians with great respect. And they, of course, showed the same to Maestro Schulte. He was a wonderful musician, and we had wonderful concerts, and he had an enormous success with the Chicago Symphony, put them on the map, et cetera, even as much as Fritz Reiner did. But it was a different relationship. It was, like he used to say, a wonderful marriage and between the members. But this was different times, and the respect that he showed the musicians, the Chicago Symphony was always a very respectful orchestra to conductors, to all conductors, guests, permanent directors. But, you know, times evolved, and suddenly you had, in Fritz Reiner's day, when he was music director, he was director for 20 or 22 weeks out of a 24-week season in those days. And that was different. So he had to probably exert himself more. But it doesn't necessarily mean that because he had such a strong control of their firing and hiring that the men played any better. You know, I mean, I can't imagine anyone playing to the best of their ability if they're frightened.
Right. Now, we're going to listen now to Maestro Schulte's successor, Daniel Barenboim, whom you also played with. And we're going to be hearing part of Strauss's Don Juan. You're going to be actually the soloist. But what should we listen for that we might hear under Baron? Okay, we're going to hear it first, and then you'll tell us what we should be listening for. Thank you. So, Sam,
yes.
Now tell us, you, as you said going into that, all these conductors got, you know, made great music with you. Fritz
right.
Reiner, George Schulte, and this, and Daniel Barenboim. But the experience obviously would have been different. Tell us a little bit, particularly since we've just heard you under the baton of Barenboim, how that might have contrasted with that earlier era, 10 or 20 or 30 years previous.
Well, it was completely different. You had conductors coming in for 2-3 weeks, even if they were music directors, and then, as I heard your guests say, of course it's true, they flew off to Berlin to do 5 operas and then 3 piano recitals. So when he came back, it was all fresh and happy again to see each other. And so this had a lot to do with the situation now, too. And, of course, there were regulations that were made life easier for everyone. I'm sorry I couldn't hear your recordings as they were. They kept popping in and out. I had no idea I recognized Don Juan, but that's about all.
Oh, that's okay. It's a liability, unfortunately, of
right,
phone conversations.
I must say the difference between the Schulte and Barenboim, Schulte had this wonderful energy and exuberance and a charisma that he always showed. With Barenboim, it was completely different, a more beautiful, a more singing sound. He spent years trying to achieve from the Chicago Symphony. I think at the end he probably did.
We're on Soundcheck talking with Sam Mogid, retired concertmaster from the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. We've got music writer Oliver Condy in the studio, and we've got James Conlon on the phone, the director of the Los Angeles Opera. James, conductors today, as Sam was kind of pointing out, have to play ball with the unions, be that as it may, some say conductor's agents still are trying to work in their little clauses into the contracts. They're still trying to hold some control over the final round of auditions or the ultimate control over the substitution list. Is this true, notwithstanding this change in eras?
Well, frankly, I don't know much about that. I certainly have nothing in any of my contracts at all. You must bear in mind that I spent over 20 years being a music director in Europe, and as of yet, I have not been a music director of a symphony orchestra in America. Now, whether I will be or not in the future, we'll see. But I don't have anything like that in any of my contracts. My relationship with the Chicago Symphony as music director of Ravinia wouldn't even include that, as my relationship to the Cincinnati Symphony in Cincinnati does not as well. Those are festivals where the orchestra is in center stage. I think the important thing, first of all, I respect those limitations, the development of rules and regulations, because there were abuses in the past. And I think, Sam, you said it very well. I mean, Fritz Reiner could look at someone's face, they played a wrong note, and out they were. That's just not acceptable. Musicians who are highly skilled and have put years into their studies, and by the way, have to keep themselves in shape much more even than a lawyer and a doctor, they need that sense of security and confidence that they're going to be able to work in a peaceful atmosphere. So I respect all those developments. You know, occasionally people find difficulties with one or the other, and I think that's normal. But I think it is necessary in our modern world that the orchestra be treated with that kind of respect, and that those kind of rules protect them from abuses. And I think in return for that, orchestras treat and deal with conductors today also in a more respectful manner, because they understand that it is a mutual relationship. I think that has changed as well.
Right. Now, Oliver, this generation, the older generation of international stars, is a bit on the wane. Bernard Haitink, Pierre Boulez, Kurt Mazur, they're in their 70s and 80s. They're still making great music, to be sure. Do we think that these up-and-comers will stay up and came, that in 30 or 40 years they'll have that stature of a George Schulte or of a Fritz Reiner?
I think the fundamental question really is how different their role is as a conductor. I mean, they now have to not only communicate to an audience. You know, a lot of conductors are called on to talk to an audience beforehand in workshops or pre-concert talks. Many of them have to set up education projects. I wouldn't have thought you would catch Toscanini, for example, talking to children about a Beethoven symphony.
We did catch him on Walt Disney anyway.
Yes.
But that was a little easier with those cartoons.
But I think as sort of education products, projects, as sort of the public image, really, that you get children in and you're able to communicate to them much more easily. Maren Allsop is a wonderful communicator to the public. She's able to turn around, talk to an audience, and then turn around and conduct a Beethoven symphony in a very sort of authoritative way. And of course, then you have the meet and greet behind the scenes. There are an awful lot of orchestras who rely on public donations, and you have to then go back and you have to meet these people, and you have to wine, you have to dine them. And that takes someone with a bit more of a relaxed character, I think.
Well, great. Well, they'll certainly have the spotlight on them, particularly on the coast in New York and L.A., and we'll all be watching to see how their careers progress. To end, we'll hear a little bit more of the music conducted by our guest on the phone, James Conlin. This is his recording of Liszt's Mephisto Waltz with the Rotterdam Philharmonic. James, Oliver, and Sam, thanks all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Still to come on the show, Jacques Schwartz-Bart, the New York-based saxophonist and composer, joins us to talk about his unusual new album that fuses guoca music from Guadeloupe with jazz. Stay with us.